Are you a perfectionist? If you've ever struggled with the need to control outcomes and make all your work achieve a nearly impossible ideal, you know that that approach to life can be punishingly stressful. But you also know that dropping that approach can be easier said than done. That's why Katherine Morgan Schaffler wrote the new book, The Perfectionist's Guide to Losing Control, A Path to Peace and Power. Katherine is a psychotherapist, writer, and speaker, and former on-site therapist at Google. And she joins us now to share five of her big ideas.
Hi, I'm Katherine Morgan Schaffler, and I'm a New York City-based psychotherapist, author, and speaker. I'm going to share with you five key insights from my book, The Perfectionist's Guide to Losing Control. Insight one. We've been looking at perfectionism all wrong. It's widely acknowledged in the field of mental health that we are in the infancy of understanding the kaleidoscopic force that is perfectionism. The more we try to nail down what perfectionism is, the more we allow ourselves to see that perfectionism simply doesn't fit inside the little ring box we've been trying to squeeze it into. With the capacity to be expressed both constructively and destructively, perfectionism is a natural human impulse that we animate through our thoughts, behaviors, feelings, and interpersonal relationships. Persisting across time and cultures, the universal desire to actualize the ideals we imagine is as healthy as the impulse to love, to solve problems, to make art, to kiss, to tell stories, and so on. And yet, in the world of commercial wellness, we continue to talk about perfectionism as if it's an unnatural, exclusively bad thing. It's not. The research world knows that perfectionism can be expressed in healthy ways, hence the decades-old concept of adaptive perfectionism, using your perfectionism to your advantage. I discuss the benefits and qualities of adaptive perfectionism throughout the book. For reasons the book also dives straight into, adaptive perfectionism has yet to break through the seal of academia and into mainstream dialogue. This means that everything you've heard about perfectionism isn't actually about perfectionism. It's about maladaptive perfectionism. Maladaptive perfectionism is the harmful and dangerous iteration of perfectionism. Part of why I wrote this book is that it stunned me that we don't differentiate between these two aspects of perfectionism. The way we currently approach perfectionism reminds me of the low-fat craze in the 90s, where all fat was considered bad. Low-fat was good, fat-free was best. There was no distinction between the healthy fats found in avocados and the unhealthy trans fats found in donuts. As our understanding of perfectionism develops, we'll abandon generalized representations of the construct. Perfectionism is a power, and like every kind of power, the power of wealth, words, beauty, love, etc., perfectionism, if you don't understand how to harness it correctly, will corrupt your life. Let's be clear about that. You need boundaries around any power, and you need boundaries around your perfectionism. Let's also be clear about this. Perfectionism, when managed well, is a gift. To unleash your gifts, you gotta stop solving for the wrong problem. Insight number two, you've been solving for the wrong problem. When you misidentify the problem, you misidentify the solution. Your problem is not that you're a perfectionist. Some of the most joyful, extraordinary, fulfilled people in the world are perfectionists. Your problem is how you respond to your perfectionism. One, you're trying to eradicate it, which I'm telling you right now will never work. And two, you're responding to your perfectionism with punishment, which is the opposite of what you should be doing. The eradication approach, here's how to get rid of your perfectionism, simply does not work. Hence why the terrible advice perfectionists are often given, just lower your standards a little bit, just don't sweat the small stuff, drives me nuts. Attempting to manage perfectionism by telling perfectionists to just not be perfectionists is like managing anger by telling people to calm down. Never in the history of the world has this approach worked, and yet it is a mainstay approach. Do you think it might be time for a different approach? The eradication approach will never work because thinking of yourself as a perfectionist is an enduring identity marker. We don't talk about perfectionism episodically because we don't experience it episodically. For example, a person may say something like, "I went through a depression after college," but we don't go through perfectionism. Perfectionism is experienced in a deep and visceral way. Thinking of yourself as a perfectionist is like thinking of yourself as an activist or an artist or a romantic. It's not an identity that you can just shake off. Perfectionists never stop noticing the gap between reality and the ideal, and they never stop longing to actively bridge that gap. The noticing and the longing last a lifetime, hence the psychical constancy to perfectionism. People who relate to being perfectionists tend to relate to that identity interminably. Trying to get rid of your perfectionism is like trying to get rid of the wind by whacking it with a broom. Perfectionism is too powerful for an eradication approach. When you try to get rid of your perfectionism, all you're doing is hemorrhaging energy at the opportunity cost of attending to your wellness. The other problematic piece of how you respond to your perfectionism is that you're responding to it with punishment. The reason punishment is problematic is insight number three. Punishment is a dumb strategy and makes everything worse. A self-punishment is consciously or unconsciously returning to something that you know will hurt you, or denying yourself something that you know will help you. Punishments are designed to create more pain. When you're punitive with yourself, the grand plan is to hurt yourself in order to teach yourself a lesson. You punish yourself for your own good. You're creating pain for yourself as a strategy for learning, growth, and healing. Punishment doesn't work. When you punish someone, including yourself, that person doesn't learn how to change. They learn how to avoid the source of the punishment. If you are the source of the punishment through critical self-talk, for example, then you learn to avoid yourself by numbing out. Numbing out looks like overeating, overspending, overworking, getting caught up in drama as a distraction tactic, substance misuse, mindlessly watching TV or scrolling through Instagram, etc. Doing all of that stuff more than you want to keeps you in pain and it keeps you stuck. People often think that they're stuck in a cycle of watching too much TV or overworking or overdrinking. No, dig a little deeper and see that what you're stuck in is a cycle of self-punishment. You don't heal yourself by hurting yourself. To sustain any kind of personal growth, you need to uncover the lessons of your past mistakes, understand what the healthier alternatives are, and believe that you're capable of change in the first place. Punishment doesn't seek to do any of that. Punishment is lazy. It just lays pain on top of whatever's there. Punishment is different from discipline, personal accountability, natural consequences, and rehabilitation. These differences are spelled out in the book. The reason we don't recognize the dysfunctional nature of punishment is because we live in a culture that broadcasts and actively promotes punishment as the go-to response for unwanted behavior. In this retributive rather than restorative culture, where punishment is the first line of defense, it makes sense that you've internalized punishment as your first line of defense against the qualities you don't like seeing in yourself. What does not make sense is for you to continue using punishment as an agent for positive change. Look at punishment up close and what you'll see is desperation. When we feel desperate and out of touch with power, we grasp onto punishment to feel in control. Feeling in control is not a substitute for empowerment. What does work to help empower you and get you unstuck? That's insight number four. Self-compassion is a brilliant strategy and makes everything better. Perfectionists hear the directive to be more compassionate with themselves as the fluffy warm-up to the actual unlock. Be nicer to myself. Got it. We're ready for the real solution. We don't understand that self-compassion is the real solution. We're confused because we're operating with a majorly watered-down idea of what self-compassion is in the first place. Self-compassion is not telling yourself, it's okay, it's all right, when things are not okay and things are not all right. Nor is self-compassion simply being polite to yourself or talking to yourself as you would a friend. According to Dr. Kristen Neff, a pioneer in self-compassion research, self-compassion is a three-step resiliency-building skill. Research indicates that responding to stress with self-compassion is one of the most effective, most powerful coping mechanisms available to us. Self-compassion bolsters well-being across the board. It improves your physical health, mental health, and relational health. Mindfulness, common humanity, and kindness, that's the trifecta that make up a self-compassionate response. We don't have EE in schools, emotional education, so we don't know what mindfulness really means, or common humanity for that matter. That doesn't mean we can't take it upon ourselves to learn. Any skill can be learned. The more you practice the skill set of self-compassion, the more your life will change. Keep in mind, being compassionate with yourself does not have to be a total personality overhaul to be effective. The amount of compassion you extend to yourself is not commensurate to the amount of healing that will unfold as a result. Giving yourself a little bit of compassion is like lighting a candle in a dark room. That tiny flicker goes a long way to brighten the entire space. Self-compassion can be a feather's weight more grace to yourself. 5 seconds. You don't even have to get up. I saved the best insight for last. Here's insight number 5. You are perfect. Yes, perfect. Not perfectly imperfect, not good enough. You are perfect. It's something between sad and strange how defensive we become about being called perfect. How can you say that? You don't even know me. I can't believe you would use that word. No. I'm definitely not. That's just not true. We feel righteously entitled to our defensive posture, so much so that we immediately feel comfortable rejecting the categorization out loud and in the moment to anyone who dares label us that way. Meanwhile, we rarely defend ourselves out loud and in the moment, or even quietly later, when someone needles us with a criticism or a judgmental remark. The word perfect comes from the Latin perficere, per, completely, and facere, do. Something considered perfect is that which is completely done. It exists in a state of completion, wholeness, perfection. When we describe something as perfect, what we're saying is that there's nothing we would add to it to make it better. Nothing more is needed because you can't add to something that's already whole. Think of someone you love. Now think of the sound of that person's laughter. Is that sound not perfect? There's nothing you could change about that laughter to make it better. It's already complete. It's already whole. We use the word perfect to emphasize completeness. When you say someone is a perfect stranger, for example, you're not saying that they're a flawless stranger. You're saying they're a complete stranger to you. You're not flawless. None of us are. But you are a whole, i.e. perfect, human being right now. The things you do don't make you whole. You're born with your wholeness. We so effortlessly acknowledge perfection in children, nature, our best friends, and yet we deny it in ourselves. What if we didn't? What would happen if we understood deeply that we're not broken? We're whole. That we've always been whole. That we don't have to fix anything to be ready for life. That we can just show up now. Once you understand that chasing perfection is about trying to access wholeness, it changes everything about the way you see and respond to your perfectionism. If you can learn to see yourself as a whole and perfect human being, you understand that you are as worthy of all the love, joy, dignity, freedom, and connection that, quote, the best, most complete, most well-accomplished human being could ever deserve. Perhaps most importantly, you learn that you don't earn your way to joy. You stop making excellent plans to be very happy later. You give yourself free access to goodness now, joy, pleasure, your own care and attention, instead of waiting to see how well you perform so that you can calculate how much goodness you deserve. Joy, love, dignity, connection, and freedom, these are birthrights, not prizes to be won through achievement sprees. You deserve them now, this very second, not because you're performing well, but because you are alive. There's wholeness inside of you. There's perfection, there's completeness, and there's freedom. There's a place where your mistakes can't touch who you are and where the past simply does not matter. That indestructible part of you in a den deep inside, what some people might call God, there's nothing you can do to break that part. If you can connect to that place inside of yourself, you will connect to your power. When you're in touch with your power, you don't need control. Those are your 5 insights from The Perfectionist Guide to Losing Control. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you, Catherine. That was Catherine Morgan Schaffler with 5 big ideas from The Perfectionist's Guide to Losing Control, A Path to Peace and Power. You might also want to check out our book bite for The Good Enough Life, by Avram Alpert. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.